In 1997, Diane Flint began planting apple trees, and in 2004, she began selling Foggy Ridge Cider and became the first licensed cidery in the South. There is just so much to say about someone who I consider Virginia's first lady of cider, but I think it's best to hear it from her. So join me in this week's chat as we speak to Diane Flint of Foggy Ridge Cider. Hey, 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 my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world.
Hip, hip, hooray!
If you are new to Cider Chat and checking out this podcast for the first time, I want to say welcome, welcome to the universe that we all know as Ciderville, which is both a virtual reality and an actual physical place. In fact, if you have an apple in your refrigerator, which a lot of people do, maybe on your table, or maybe you are walking through the grocery store right now in the fruit section, you are in a special spot of Ciderville. It's where you might only be, but as such, I do feel that we're all kind of connected, which is the beauty of this podcast. This podcast covers folks worldwide. I am based in the U.S. myself, but my interest for cider is not only U.S.-based, but it's definitely worldwide. And it's just such an exciting world, isn't it? In fact, I have a mini little announcement to say. I kind of hold this back because I don't like to say until it's like absolutely definite. But some who regularly listen to the podcast and those just tuning in will now know that I lead something called Totally Cider Tours. And I have been itching like nobody's business in the worst way, the worst kind of itch, to get back out and bring some cider tours to all of you. And this year, 2022, we are now looking towards the fall. And I am definitely hoping in the coming weeks to have an announcement for the French tour to Normandy and Brittany. Yeah, oh my gosh, I can't even tell you. It's so much fun preparing a cider tour and thinking about the people who love going on these Totally Cider Tours. We all, from the get-go, have a common thread which really sets apart the tour to begin with, because by and large, folks find out about Totally Cider Tours via Cider Chat and Cider Chat's social media. And as such, there is a certain sensibility in each person that comes along and an immediate connection. It's absolutely grand. I just love it. And then there's, on top of that, we get to go and drink cider and have a gastronomic experience of sightseeing, food, good conversation. I love that so much. I never grow tired of that. And to be able to return to France and to see the landscape, the sky, the sea, and of course, the people. You couple that with sightseeing, cider, and gastronomic experiences, and you just have a win-win. And I mean, the cream of the crop is really the people, and that is you. So if you're interested in going on a Totally Cider tour with me, send an email to info@ciderchat.com. Let me know who you are. You don't have to write a whole paragraph, of course. Just say, hey, you know, keep me posted. Put you on the list and give you first dibs when this goes live in the coming weeks. And before you know it, we'll be walking down the Champs-Élysées with a croissant in one hand and a bottle of cider in the other. What's not to love about that?
Walking through the orchards.
It's that time of year where folks start going out and they're pruning their apple trees and getting all ready for the season ahead and spring blossoms. But it's never too early to start thinking about the next cider or perry that you're going to be fermenting. So if you want a balanced, sweet, fruity, or crisp cider, Fermentis is the obvious choice for beverage fermentation, and they are now offering an expanded range of cider yeast. Learn more about how Fermentis can improve the quality of your cider fermentation and for the latest on their exciting new product release by going to fermentis.com. Now, Fermentis is a sponsor of Cider Chat, and as such, All I could say is by supporting them, you support Cider Chat. So that is like a win-win. And to top it off, I'm going to be recording an episode with one of the Fermentis technicians, which means you get to send in your questions now for that recording, which is going to be taking place in late spring, early summer. So if there was a cider that you made this past fall, this is a good opportunity to like take those notes that you put down back then. Hopefully you took your notes. And I know that's a problem for me too. It's okay. Just try to remember what went right or maybe what could have been done differently or why that happened that way. If you're still kind of scratching your head on that, send that question my way and we'll use it during this recording. And if there is a question about a future fermentation before you even get there, those questions are fine too. Send them my way to info@ciderchat.com. It's time now to go to our featured conversation with Diane Flynn. She was actually featured in last week's episode on keynote speakers at CiderCon 2022, where you can hear the recording of her keynote address to the opening of CiderCon, which was held in Richmond, Virginia. While there, I had the opportunity to have a sit-down talk with her, and that is this recording now. A little bit more about Diane Flynn if you didn't catch last week's recording or don't really know too much about the Virginia scene. Once again, she was the first licensed cidery, it was called, and is called Foggy Ridge Cider, which began selling cider in 2004 and then continued all the way up to 2018, where she kind of changed her business model and now is solely growing apples and selling them to local and regional cider makers. And having been nominated for the James Beard Award in 2015, 2016, and then becoming a finalist for that same award in 2017 and 2018, she does talk about how that was the right choice to kind of switch her business model and get herself out in the orchard, which is really one of the reasons why I feel like a kindred spirit to Diane in that I could tell she just absolutely loves trees. So let's all grab a glass and join this chat with Diane Flynn of Foggy Ridge Cider based in Duxbury, Virginia.
I grew up in a small town in Georgia, in the Piedmont region of Georgia, right on the Chattahoochee River, which is the border between the states of Alabama and Georgia. It's red clay country. My grandparents were farmers and had a few apple trees, but I always felt a connection to the land. And even though my dad was not a farmer, he was a scientist, we always had a garden that could feed a family of 12, and I was always interested in and very connected to the natural world. Plus, we visited my grandparents. They were only 16 miles away, so we visited them every week and very involved in their farm life. When I graduated from college, I could not see my way to farming. I had college loans. It was in the middle of a recession. The only model I could see out there for being a farmer was to, I don't know, maybe grow pot in my basement. Or
what were you studying?
This is the 70s.
All right. Was, okay.
I just couldn't see my way to being a farmer as my first career. So I had a business career and was a pioneer as a woman in the business world in the 70s, in the late 70s. And had a great career in financial services in North Carolina and had the privilege of working for a great organization at a time when it was growing and developing its people and really beginning to see that women perhaps had a place in the business world. So often I'm painted as a corporate refugee. But I actually really liked my corporate job, my corporate career, which was 20 years. And I learned so many things that I could put to work in farming and growing apples and running a business, running a cider business. I met my husband when I was 40, and my career goal at that time was to work in the corporate world until I had enough money that I could be a farmer. And when we first fell in love, I said, well, honey, you know I'm going to have a farm and have a farm business. And he said, oh, yeah. Because his parents had been farmers. His grandparents had been farmers, and they were tobacco farmers in North Carolina. And he'd spent his whole life running away from the farm. But that was, my point of view won out, and we spent several years looking for farmland close to where we were working at the time, which is Greensboro, North Carolina, and beginning to conceive of a farm-based business that could be a real business, not a hobby business, and that could also have some of the pioneering spirit that I experienced and enjoyed in the business world. And we eventually bought land in the southwestern corner of Virginia. Virginia is a very big state, and this is not at all what people think of when they think of northern Virginia, close to D.C., urban areas. I mean, we are 9 miles from a gas station and 25 miles from a grocery store. So very, very remote, but very beautiful, and a traditional apple-growing area. We're on something called the Blue Ridge Plateau, which is an interesting geological feature of southwestern Virginia dipping down into North Carolina, a little bit in Tennessee. And it's you climb an escarpment of over 2,000 feet up to what is beautiful, rolling, gentle hills, but those hills are at 3,000, 3,500 feet. So our farm is hilly, but not, you know, mountain steep. But our property is, our main orchards are at 3,000 feet. Mm-hmm. So it's the southernmost zone 5 planting area. Our climate is more like, you know, the Hudson River Valley, you know, than it is for what people think of as the South.
That's great. That's wonderful. Yeah.
And apples very quickly came up as an agricultural venture. And at the time when I began, when we purchased our land and I began conceiving of a business in the mid-90s, Virginia had, Virginia's wine industry was beginning to grow in reputation, beginning to make better quality wine, and beginning to devote some state resources to the beverage industry. And I saw cider making as a possibility for the South. I'd gotten to know people like Steve Wood at Farnham Hill, and actually Autumn Stoschek and I think started our cideries at right about the same time. She's much younger than I am, but I was really inspired by some of those early cider makers in other parts of the country to think, well, you know, I could do this in the South too.
Do you remember the first cider that you had?
Oh gosh, it was a French cider. I'm sure. Well, actually, no. I think it actually was a French cider because I did a term abroad in college. And
in Normandy.
I was in Paris in school, but penniless. So cider was
a cider bouche.
Yes, I imbibed a lot of cider.
Yeah.
And, of course, that formed my idea of cider, and I still really enjoy cider from Normandy and think it's such a great pairing with their food. And the fact that it was made by farmers too,
yes.
I thought, you know, this is like that model of the, you know, the Italian grape grower on his hillside or her hillside growing grapes and making a farm-based beverage. That can be done with apples, too.
Let's give folks a little bit of a timeline. You opened Foggy Ridge Cider commercially in what was the year?
So we planted the first orchard in 1997, and I applied for my ABC license in 2013. We started fermenting then, and we sold our first cider in 2014. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, back up, yeah.
COVID has caused me to lose a decade.
I was kind of wondering about it. Yeah, I'll let you go with it.
Planted the first orchard in 1997, applied for our ABC license in 2003, and sold our first cider in 2004.
That makes more sense. I will not question Diane Flint.
Yeah, COVID causes you to lose.
It is. So we are all on the same page.
What happened to the team?
I know. There's something going on there. Yeah. You were making cider. More recently, you stopped making cider to, you know, teary eyes everywhere. And folks still talk about, myself included, I was in California just a year ago, and I was able to find some of your cider at a co-op, and somebody gave me a hint, like, there's some Foggy Ridge cider at New Leaf. You got to go there. And I was able to hunt it down. I haven't seen it since. So, you know, it's like coveted cider from you.
Antique cider. Well, needs to be drunk now.
Well, that could be true. Yeah. What was the decision for that?
You know, it was a lot of things. My vision was to be a grower and a maker, and also to sell our cider direct to consumer, but to distribute most of our cider through distributors because of our remote location. Mm-hmm. We had a great tasting room. It was open on weekends 9 months a year. And we had a really successful cider club and an online store very early. So So I was very happy with the direct-to-consumer side of what we did and really didn't want to do more of that. But as we grew and to meet the demands of our distributors, I increasingly found myself in the role of national sales manager. And I would, at the end of the week, I would realize, you know, I spent all my time at my desk in front of the laptop on the phone, and I didn't, I wasn't in the orchard.
Right.
And I remember having to really push myself away and structure my time so I could lead the blending trials. And those should be central. I kept saying, these should be central to my role. But our business got to be a real bit, it got to be, not a huge business, but it got to be a big business.
Demanding all your time.
A demanding business.
Yeah.
And so our question became, for me and my husband, do we either really grow this so that we can hire someone to do the business side and I can go back to the orchard and back to being, I was always hands-on in cider making, but back to doing more of that. Or, you know, what do we do? And at our age, my husband's 13 years older than I am, and he's 81 now, so you can do the math backwards. We just really didn't want to get bigger. We didn't want to. We both had had big business careers. Foggy Ridge had been a success beyond our wildest dreams, and we didn't want to get bigger. We actually looked at getting smaller, but then I would be like the full-time tank cleaner, so I wasn't so sure I wanted to go back to that.
Good choice. So
the best choice, and I, of course, always knew I wanted to continue to grow apples and continue to be involved in the cider industry. Yeah. So the best choice we came up with was to retire the Foggy Ridge Cider brand and to sell our fruit to other cider makers. And that really was the best decision. It was kind of a wonderful bow on the end of our cider making career to get that second finalist slot at the James Beard Award, and you know, the, as we were going into our last year, to have that opportunity. Of course, I didn't know it at the time, but looking back, that was that was the right, when we made that decision a year later, it was like that was the right timing.
Yeah.
And now I sell our fruit to other cider makers. We don't grow, you know, we're not exporting to, you know, Cuba and Brazil like some other Virginia apple growers are, but I'm able to sell to half a dozen cider makers, mostly in North Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, West Virginia, kind of tight to where we are. We're in that corner of all those states. Mm-hmm. And it's just lovely to see their success. I am thrilled to taste the ciders that they're making because mm-hmm. they have such, I mean, they have so many different styles. I am thrilled to see them have success. Mm-hmm. One of the ciders that is made with our fruit won a Good Food Award this year. Another one won a Governor's Cup gold medal. Another one won something at Glencap.
Are they able to put Foggy Ridge cider?
Yeah, they can put whatever
on their label.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's good.
And some use our name in marketing.
Marketing, yeah. I'm sure who wouldn't.
Yeah, and many are blending our apples with their own apples.
Sure.
And I'm proud of that contribution we make too. So that has been really lovely, and it's enabled me to really look at my orchard as an orchard of fruit I will sell rather than use. Mm-hmm. When I was using everything that came out of the orchard, I looked at it a little bit differently because I could take off, if I didn't have 10 bins of fruit, I had two, I could always press two bins and usually have tank space for it. Mm-hmm. Now I'm concentrating my fruit into early season apples when our big planting of Hughes crab comes in. So Hughes crab and Parmar and some other early season apples. And then that kind of early middle season for me, September mm-hmm. apples. And then I'm investing in planting or top working over some late fruit, which I did not grow formally because I leased an orchard of Albemarle pippins nearby in Benton Mountain, Virginia.
I see.
And that was my late season fruit.
Nice. So
I'm planting winter john or top working over winter john, mm-hmm. which is an old southern cider apple that I'm really, really excited about.
That's lovely, yeah.
And I've planted or top and top worked Redfield, which is Redfield for me has such an emotional connection because Terry Maloney at West County Cider was so influential in my view of cider and in my cider story, and the cider that Terry made in the 90s, mm-hmm. the Redfield cider he made is still probably my favorite cider ever.
Actually,
I got my grafting wood from Redfield, from Field Maloney.
Nice.
Yes, I feel like I have a little bit of Terry in the orchard.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that. It always brings a little tear to my eye, talking about Terry. Mm-hmm. So with your long view of cider, I was wondering if there's something that you've seen. It would be nice to just have your vantage point of what you've seen about cider, the cider market kind of changing, or just actually the cider industry changing mm-hmm. over the years. Do you have any insight on that, on how you've seen it growing and the direction that it's going? Does it surprise you, or would you have thought, I thought it was going to go in this direction, but actually it's going here?
You know, I think once we had national brands, good, strong national brands, well-capitalized brands that decided to compete with beer, then that set that segment of cider in a certain direction. It resulted in lower alcohol level ciders, more session ciders. And mm-hmm. there's certainly a place for well-made session cider. I enjoy that after a bike ride.
Some of the best French ciders are very low alcohol.
Absolutely. And, very enjoyable mm-hmm. beverage. Mm-hmm. And I think you see in cider a much more complex industry than it was in the early days when it was basically one or two commercial cideries, and then everybody else was growing their own fruit and mm-hmm. making their cider. Mm-hmm. I think it's good to have lots of different business models and lots of different approaches to cider. We have urban cideries now, which I think is wonderful. When that first happened, I was very skeptical. I was like, these people aren't going to know anything about apples. They aren't growing anything. But what I've seen with people like Wisebird in Lexington, Kentucky, and Blue Bee here in Virginia, they actually have strong relationships with orchardists. They're able to pay enough for fruit that those orchards are planting trees for them. Mm-hmm. They're involved in research. It's to me one of the most exciting things, mm-hmm. because they are located where the people are. They're in the urban areas, and they can expose mm-hmm. more consumers to cider than I can, mm-hmm. you know, located 25 miles from a bad food lion.
So that would lead me to, is there anything you would have done differently had you known then what you know now?
You know, my husband Chuck and I talk about that a lot, and I would have certainly planted different trees, because my first orchard was my test orchard, and mm-hmm. I planted, I think, 35 varieties of cider apples, you know, 12 trees of each variety, mm-hmm. and, you know, some of those I would definitely not plant them again. So I've learned a lot about the apples that will grow in my place that will produce fruit, and that produce fruit that mm-hmm. make great cider. So mm-hmm. certainly the trees that I would plant.
Let's just stop there for a minute, because I know a lot of folks listening right now are in that same boat that you were back then. And it's hard to know what's going to work well in your orchard. And I think my first thought, it just requires patience and time. That it's not something, as a craft, it takes time to kind of be able to delve into that and get to know it. Is there any other way to do that?
Well, now, back in the mid-90s, of course, there were dwarfing rootstocks, but it was not as common a planting mm-hmm. method. Mm-hmm. But now you can get, you know, in 2 or 3 years, you can figure out what you want. Or you can begin to get fruit.
Right.
And you'll know, even in the first planting year, mm-hmm. you'll know a little bit about how mm-hmm. that tree is performing mm-hmm. in your climate and on your soil. You'll see how much growth mm-hmm. it's putting on. You'll see a little bit about the growth habits. You'll know your bloom dates and your mm-hmm. harvest dates, and you'll be mm-hmm. able to, you know, see if it's being properly pollinated. So mm-hmm. yeah, I think today you can plant fruit and get that knowledge turnaround much faster mm-hmm. on dwarf stock. And I mm-hmm. could have done that too, but it just wasn't as common,
yeah,
or as it
right.
wasn't in the foreground of my own orchard planting. So I think different apples for sure. And I think I probably would have continued with a tasting facility on our farm, because it was fun to talk to people about cider, and I learned a lot about consumers by standing behind that tasting table and having them come in the early days and say, what grape is this made from? Since there were no other cideries in mm-hmm. the South. But I think we would have invested in an urban tasting room. In Virginia, the ABC laws allow you to have multiple locations under your same license.
Any particular cities that you have gone into?
Yeah, probably Charlottesville.
Charlottesville, okay.
Because it's close enough to us we could have managed it.
Is that like 4 hours or so?
3 hours.
3 hours?
Yeah. Could have managed it. You know, could have probably, perhaps could have found good staff. Mm-hmm. There's a great food and beverage community, mm-hmm. real professional food and beverage folks there, mm-hmm. good deep restaurant knowledge and good palates, and several great wine stores. So I think we could have recruited someone. It would have been tough to manage a remote business like that, but I think that could have put cider on the map in Virginia earlier. Mm. And I think it could have given us, a better retail presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. That would have been interesting to see. And that's good insight for startups now looking forward. It's really about location and being able to source your product to that location, mm-hmm. and bringing those factors into play. If you are really in a rural setting, You got to make a really good product to get those folks there.
You end up distributing it, which I like. I never wanted to sell all of our product direct to consumers. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't a model that mm-hmm. was sustainable for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be in the hospitality business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think it's a wonderful business, and I love the wineries and cideries in Virginia that do mm-hmm. such a good job with on-site sales. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky. Our early distributors were wonderful to work with. I know many cider makers and winemakers have distributor horror stories, and I have one or two.
I'm sure.
There's one that still owes me money.
Oh, jeez.
But no, for the most part, our distributors were very supportive.
That's great.
They were partners. I was their first, for many of them, other than maybe one French cider, I was their first cider in their portfolio, and they were open to learning. And I still count, I mean, there are two distributors I, you know, visit, and we go out to dinner together still, you know, years
later. That's a nice relationship to have, yeah.
Yeah, they come visit and stay on the farm with their families.
Awesome.
And
wow.
So I had good distributor relationships throughout our cider-making career.
Cool.
I know the distributor market has changed dramatically, and it will continue to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly COVID changed wholesale beverage sales. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. restaurants were not operating. Mm-hmm. But I think good distributors that are nimble and know the industry can pivot.
Mm-hmm.
The issue for distributors now is there's so much consolidation, and so many of the smaller distributors that carried Foggy Ridge have now been swallowed up by big, truly conglomerates.
Conglomerates, yeah.
I mean, truly conglomerates. Yeah. And a small producer of any size and any quality level will get lost in that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
that would be a tough... That would be a tough thing now. But there are more small distributors coming up.
There are, yeah, because it's always an ever-changing market. Now, you had mentioned Autumn at Eve's Cidery and also Terry Maloney up at West County, and that's in western Massachusetts, my special spot of Ciderville.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if there were other role models that really informed you early on.
Well, Terry was such an inspiration. I'll never forget going through his orchard at one, probably the first cider days there in Coleraine. And is it Deerfield? Greenfield and Deerfield.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were walking through his orchard, and there was a lot of snow on the ground, but there had been more. And he had rabbit damage about 3 feet up the tree where the snow had fallen, and the rabbits had chewed the trees 3 feet off the ground.
Yeah, you can't fence off on that.
No.
Yeah.
So he was just such a positive person and such a big thinker.
Yeah.
And I think what Terry taught me is to think big. Not in terms of building a big business, but think in terms of having a big impact.
Mm.
And
mm.
it's like I mentioned in my talk this morning to CiderCon of mm-hmm. I wanted Foggy Ridge Cider to have a voice in the national beverage discussion, but I more wanted cider to have a voice mm-hmm. and a place at the table mm-hmm. in the national beverage discussion.
Yeah.
So he was very instrumental. Steve was, especially in terms of trees and fruit varieties. Autumn was very much an inspiration because of the meticulous way she goes about everything and her commitment to growing, to getting fruit from the orchard, which mm-hmm. has always been
mm-hmm.
mine.
Yeah.
Another person... who is no longer making cider, but I believe is still involved in the industry, is Nick Gunn at Wandering Angus.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
we started our cideries at about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to some trainings together and often talked by phone. And I felt a lot of comradeship with him. We went through a lot of the same questions in problem solving at the same stage.
Oh, fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a really nice guy. Well, that leads me to... Now, is there anyone that you're kind of, you know, noticing in the industry now that's saying, okay, I want to kind of keep my eye on this person?
There's so many. There's a long list for that. And I have to say, my answers are going to be very Southern-centric.
That's fine. Give a little spotlight out in the South. Well, that's where we are. It's okay. Don't be offended out there if she doesn't mention you. She still loves you, okay?
I've been researching this book I'm writing on the history of apples and cider in the South, so I've been very Southern-centric.
That's great.
I think the folks at James Creek Cider House in North Carolina,
Anne Marie and David Thornton,
are so talented. They started off as growers and selling fruit at the, mm-hmm. Carver, North Carolina Farmer's Market, mm-hmm. which is an epic farmer's market, by the way. And they approached cider both as growers, as farmers, but really as scientists. You know, they bring a lot of scientific know-how to what they do. And I think when you do that, you learn more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I am still enthralled with urban cideries and love what Courtney does, Courtney Maley at Blue Bee. Mm-hmm. She is working very closely with growers to encourage them to plant certain apples, even giving them Scion Wood of varieties that she finds or mm-hmm. learns about. And then, promising to purchase or, having whatever arrangement she has, mm-hmm. but to be really good partners mm-hmm. with growers mm-hmm. In, as far as I know, just Virginia, but mm-hmm. but we have lots of growers in Virginia mm-hmm. she works with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another interesting cider approach that would be useful for those regions that don't have a big apple culture is Wisebird Cider in Lexington, Kentucky. Now, Kentucky has a bit of an apple business, but mm-hmm. not a lot. And he's working with University of Kentucky mm-hmm. researchers to test cider apples and then convince these commercial apple growers who are seriously thinking about going out of business. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute, don't go out of business yet. You mm-hmm. can grow these apples.
Mm-hmm.
So Wisebird Cider is an urban cidery, mm-hmm. but it's one that has the potential to create a real revival of these orchards that...
in that region.
Yeah, they just can't make money selling Red Delicious. And a lot of them are beginning to grow grapes for mm-hmm. a burgeoning wine industry there. Mm. And so I've always... this is a slightly different subject, but I'm always liked to find apple growers who also grow wine grapes because they really understand flavor. Here in Virginia, Silver Creek Orchard grows wine grapes. They're a five mm-hmm. generation mm-hmm. orchard, but they also grow wine grapes. So they really understand flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes with a commercial apple grower, it's tough. They're concerned about shipping and storage mm-hmm. and harvest times and kind of the business aspect of the apple, the flavors down there. Right. But people who grow wine grapes and apples really understand flavor.
But as a grower, an orchardist, a lover of trees, mm-hmm. what are you noticing?
And this has been documented by Virginia Tech. My frost date has not changed really since 1997. It's not that we have later frosts. It's that we have warm winter days and warm days in early spring. So my trees are further along mm-hmm. than they have ever been when that last frost date comes, which for me is May 10th. Now, by May 10th, my Hughes crab apples have bloomed.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're out of that vulnerable pink stage, I can get through those last few frosts, which are often frosts, not freezes.
Right, right.
But what's happening now is that trees are breaking dormancy so much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They're often in the most vulnerable stages of bloom
mm-hmm.
during those late April, early May mm-hmm. frosts, which we've always had.
Right,
but the trees are just not as dormant as
not
they
as dormant,
were.
Yeah.
So I think going forward, people will really need to carefully check, carefully plan their tree selection by bloom time I can see going to later varieties or sticking with really early varieties so that you aren't in such a vulnerable place. I mean, since 1997, we have only lost a significant crop twice.
That's pretty amazing.
It was the last 2 years.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So that is 2021 and 2020.
Right.
Well, that was a bad time for everybody. Let's hope that's over with.
Now, we had a decent crop this year. We had an excellent crop of everything that made it through our last freeze. But we lost our whole Hughes crab crop this year. The only second time in over 20 years.
I wonder with, there's like not a rest time of dormancy for the trees. And I just wonder about the vitality for a tree in that way. You know, we push it kind of like an agricultural animal, you know, like move that cattle through, you know, the stockade, and you see orchardists who will do that with apples. And because as humans, we want to keep on pushing it through. But is there something about the vitality of the tree that climate change, that warmer piece will affect? And maybe that answer is unknown at this point.
So I'd have to talk to the pomologist about that. Now, the varieties have different requirements for chill hours or chill days. So that comes into play. Mm-hmm. But, we do achieve dormancy. It's just the the bud break in the spring is it's so fractious. And we'll have... At Christmas, we had 20 degrees one day and 70 degrees
the next day. Yeah. I mean, that's stressful for humans.
Yes, it is.
I know that.
Like,
where are
my shorts?
Yeah, right.
Put those away already.
you don't know which direction to go, you know, up or down. I wanted to move on to like a kind of a fun topic here. And so it's kind of like, and this is kind of what comes first to your mind. Your kind of favorite eating apple?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I actually like some of the modern apples. I mean, I kind of don't want to like Cosmic Crisp, but actually
you
it's
do.
A pretty good apple. It's not bad.
Cosmic Crisp growers are smiling.
I know. And then Greg Pak, who's a real inspiration to me. I have not mentioned him, but although he's not a commercial cider maker, he certainly makes a lot of cider at Cornell, Dr. Greg Pak.
Yeah.
And his research is so valuable to the whole industry, not just to New York State. And he has an excellent online seminars and talks. Mm-hmm. And then his fruit page for Cornell showing his research and publications is also very useful and well worth a visit.
And a great last name for being the apple business.
Greg Pak, and we had him in Virginia briefly, but he was lured back to his alma mater.
Oh, darn.
I tasted some New York State apples when I was up at Cornell, and I can't remember the names of them, but they were delicious eating apples. Of the apples I grow, I really like these little... that dessert classification, the Golden Harveys, Pitmaston pineapples, the little, you know, almost pineapple-shaped, little 2-inch apples. You can eat them in 4 bites.
Little nimble,
And they are so intensely flavored. I mean, you couldn't eat a bigger one. it's a lot of flavor for a little apple. Those are just spicy treats.
Okay. How about cider? And I know that there's blends of cider, but is there... I'm just wondering because I spoke to a number of Virginia makers, but is there one that you just love seeing in cider and showcasing?
Well, I think Hughes crab is always a wonderful addition. Everybody talks about that. I think we do need to grow apples other than Hughes crab. I think there's so many different apples that can confer flavor.
Yeah.
I'm a blender. I appreciate what people do with single varietals as an experiment, but I think virtually every cider I've ever tasted is better with some other percentage of some other apple in there, even if you're just adding 10 or 15%.
Eric Bordelais would agree.
I think a blended cider is better than a single varietal.
Right.
I just stake myself out like that.
That's okay.
But I do like the experimentation of seeing what single varietals will do. I grow an old Southern cider and brandy apple called Parmar, a P-A-R-M-A-R. That's an excellent cider apple. It should be more widely planted.
And for brandy, too.
Because it's so high in sugar.
So high in sugar.
Yeah.
Great.
Very high Brix. Mm-hmm. But lots of acidity and soft tannins. I am planting at my advanced age a Winter John, which is a Southern cider apple. It's a late season apple.
Mm-hmm.
I told you I'm putting in more late season apples.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I love Redfield. I've talked about mm-hmm. that. And then there's some apples I don't grow, but I've tasted. I think the whole limber twig family is fascinating. And red limber twig and mm-hmm. black limber twig, mm-hmm. I think, are great cider apples. There's a Southern cider apple from coastal North Carolina called Madame Mesquite. It carries a
Madame Mesquite?
M-A-T-T-A.
Okay.
M-U-S-K-E-E-T. It's the name of an indigenous tribe in indigenous people in eastern North Carolina. There's a Lake Madame Mesquite.
Right.
I don't know that there's a connection to this tribe, but there is certainly the place name. Oh. It has acquired
mm-hmm.
has acquired the name of these mm-hmm. of this indigenous group who may or may not have grown the apple. But it's I think an interesting apple.
Yeah.
And James Creek Cider House makes cider with Madame Mesquite, and well worth planting. You know, really. And these Southern apples. One reason I'm so interested in them is the subject you just brought up of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
These apples have flourished in hot, humid conditions for centuries.
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 They know how to do it. Yeah.
And they know how to do it.
Yeah. You have to go in that. I was kind of curious what the 5-year, 10-year plan is for you at this point, looking forward.
Yeah. Well, I certainly continue to enjoy selling my fruit, growing fruit and selling it to cider makers, and I don't anticipate changing that. And mm-hmm. the shifts I'm making in the orchard are tweaks to make to get some fruit out there that's not going to be out there any other way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm top working all my Newtown pippins over to Winter John.
Right on.
I mean, there are enough Albemarle pippins in the world. I can do some good by getting some of these apples out and getting them noticed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a book for the University of North Carolina Press. My deadline for a first draft is this summer, so I'm still deep into writing the final sections of that book. And it'll be a year and a half review process. It's an academic press, so there'll be a peer review mm-hmm. process. And then it takes a year to get a book published. So
is that all on Southern apples,
it's
then?
The history of apples in the South.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And a little bit of my own story woven in, but a very story-driven look at this ingredient that is so unexpected for the South. People don't think of the South as a site for apples, but mm-hmm. it actually was very rich and mm-hmm. I think stands alongside New England as a source of interesting apples. Many of the apples that went west came from us
mm-hmm.
and came from New England. But I do think each region has, as Dan Pucci has explored in his his book, each region has an interesting apple history.
It sure does.
That's well worth a deep exploration.
Yeah. One last piece here is when we were corresponding, you told me about a ring that you have with an oak tree, one of the oak tree on your property, and it's called a signet ring, which would be, so I'm holding this ring right now, and these rings were known to be used for, you dab it into some hot wax, or maybe put wax on the ring.
Put the wax on the letter.
On the letter, and then you put your little insignia on it. And so this is a oak tree that is on your property. And also, if you get those special bottles, on just one of the bottles, right?
On our last cider that we bottled,
that's beautiful.
We called it Foggy Ridge Final Call. And we really wanted a different label and wanted a sense of you know, have the labels say something about that this was the final cider that we would make, but that I wasn't stopping trees.
Yeah.
So I had always loved this tree. The front door of our house is centered on an axis with this tree. It stands alone in a field, which is rare because we're in a really rural area, mm-hmm. and this land was grazed by sheep, grazed by cattle, mm. and for this oak tree to be there. And it's a distinctive oak tree, as you could see from the ring.
Yeah.
It has a beautiful twisted shape, and it's a very healthy, you know, 150-plus-year-old oak tree standing in the middle of a field.
Right.
In thunderstorm season, when I turn in our driveway, I'm just crossing my fingers it's not struck by a thunderstorm. So the label shows a silhouette of this tree with me walking toward the tree, not away from the tree.
Well, that was just one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk to you, to tell you the truth, is that your passion for trees is something that I really share. And, you know, it goes beyond just a cider. That you, to be in this industry, you know, it starts with the outer environment, being mm-hmm. out and in the orchard, and that's not an apple tree on your finger, mm-hmm. that's an oak tree, mm-hmm. and that's like rooted into the ground, and I think that just speaks volumes for who you are. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you for all you've done for the cider industry and your work and your cider making, and wish you all the best luck with your book and moving forward.
Well, thank you so much. I'll come back and talk about the book when it gets published.
I will hold you to that. Thank you.
Thanks again.
A big tip of glass to Olympic Bluffs Cider in Washington State, the American Cider Association, Taddy Bogle Cider Works in Acme, Pennsylvania, Esoterra Cider in Dolores, Colorado, Insider Japan, the country's only bilingual and English magazine dedicated to cider, Spacetime Mead and Cider Works based in Dunmore, Pennsylvania, Duck Chicken Cider in London, and Ross-on-Wye Cider and Perry Company based in Ross-on-Wye in the UK. And of course, all the fine patrons of this here podcast who donate via the Cider Chat Patreon page and the donate button at ciderchat.com. You can find those links at the Cider Chat website or just Google Cider Chat Patreon. It's spelled Patreon. And with that, I leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. We like palms. We love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider. We like palms. We like orchards. Having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, yeah.
We like cider.
Oh, yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We love orchards.
Having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!